Good evening, America. Good afternoon, Australia. And welcome to all our listeners listening live on LinkedIn, Facebook, and YouTube. You're listening to Tony Lontis on Radio Tony Everyday Business. And it's a bit of a momentous day today. You guys in America have voted and we're slowly watching some numbers come in. I haven't watched for an hour or so, so if anyone's got any update on that. But a big momentous day for all of you listening from America and all of us watching keenly on from Australia. Now, just a reminder that you can listen to this show live on the socials of LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook, and you can catch up on the podcast version of the live show by jumping onto anywhere that you get your podcast from. Alternatively, just jump on to radiotony.com where you'll find all sorts of information about our amazing guest, Lisa, and today we have joining us the glorious Irene Lomas. But before I introduce Irene, I want Lisa to do that, and I want Lisa to tell us just a little bit about her upcoming webinars. Over to you, Lisa.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, everyone. I hope everyone's had a good day or continuing to have a good day, even though there are some looming decisions ahead or outcomes ahead. Let me see. First of all, I'd like to introduce you to my wonderful colleague, Irene Lomas. Irene is one of the principal consultants at the Governance Collective, a very valuable member of our team, and I will be giving Irene an opportunity to tell us a little bit about herself as well. But before we go there, I'd like to have a bit of a chat, let you know what's going on in regard to the delivery of training for individuals who are interested in learning about how to be a heart-centered governing leader. We have had some requests to deliver some training to support individuals who'd like to increase their skills around being heart-centered from a governing leadership standpoint, and we do have training available. So if you'd like to jump on to Tony's website, she has got the link available there for you to book in for training. And we also have it included as part of our blog from last week, and it is on the Governance Collective's website, www.governancecollective.com.au. And it's a really great piece of training, Tony, because not only are we helping people support them around how they can behave within the work environment, but we're also providing them some assistance on how to work around ego-centered leaders. Which is a really, really important piece, because you can be as heart-centered a governing leader as, you know, the best of them, but it can be challenging sometimes to work around some of those ego-centered leaders, can't it, Tony?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Absolutely. I think we could all have stories of leaders that we've worked with, particularly in the corporate environment, that are not leading from their hearts and they are ego-centered, and it makes for a really difficult environment to work in, and challenging on a personal level as well. So Lisa, we've been talking about heart-centered leadership for a number of weeks now, and this week we wanted to continue that conversation, but we wanted to relate a discussion around conflicts of interest, which leads us into related party transactions, ethics, values, boundaries, and behaviours, which is a fascinating discussion and one I'm really looking forward to having. So, Lisa, I'm going to hand over to you and let you introduce the lovely Irene, and let's get started talking about this conflicts of interest around governance and in business.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm really excited about this conversation as well. It's an incredibly topical focus area for a lot of organisations. And Irene and I have both had quite a significant amount of experience supporting organisations in navigating through what sometimes can be quite complex matters from a decision-making standpoint. But before we go there, Irene, I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners and those viewing today.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. And it's really good to be with you, Tony. And thank you for this opportunity as well. So I'm a principal consultant with the Governance Collective. My working life has actually travelled and meandered along several paths, you know, over the past few decades, like has been the experience of a lot of people, I imagine. So I've been quite fortunate because I've worked both in corporate, private sector, and also in the public sector as well. So I've got a bit of a view into all those environments, but the challenges are pretty much common to all those environments. So I started my work life as a baby lawyer, and then I became an adult lawyer, and then I decided that I'd use my education and my experience and my knowledge to actually work in another field altogether. And the other field altogether is all about supporting organisations and individuals with their decision-making processes and with their governance arrangements. I'm quite passionate about transparent and accountable decision-making, whether it's by individuals or organisations or businesses. So that's kind of my background, and it's in that context that I met Lisa, and we've been working together for a number of years now. And yes, we've had some interesting experiences in, you know, decision making, boundaries, and assisting organisations kind of push through some barriers that might exist for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it can be a really challenging discussion in corporate level and big organisations, just as challenging as it can be in small organisations that have family members working within their business. And so that leads us to one of our key topics for today, and that's around related party transactions. So Lisa, can you tell our listeners and audience what are related party transactions and why are we having this important discussion today?
Really, really great question. And as you said, very, very topical right now. A related party transaction, in really, really simple terms, is a decision-making that is occurring between two organisations, two or more organisations, where there is a related entity. Typically, it's an individual, or it may actually be hierarchically around how the structure of the organisations have been set up. And what actually happens is, in a lot of cases, even unbeknown to the individuals that are involved in those two organisations, the decision-making actually gets quite blurred, because they're actually not coming from a place where the decision-making is in the best interest of the shareholders, the people who actually own the organisation. There are quite a few things that can play out around how related party transactions can play. There can be really, really large impacts when related parties are undertaking decision-making, especially when something as complex as external or government funding is involved as well, because there is an expectation that the decision-making entity is undertaking clean, uninfluenced decisions with no other organisations or other related parties outside of the process impacting on the decision making in any way, shape or form. It's a very, very close dynamic with conflicts of interest and conflicts management. Isn't that right, Irene?
Yeah. It is. And we're seeing certain things playing out in our environment here that relate to conflicts and managing them, and what are they. And, you know, there are lots of us around the globe that are seeing those kind of words being hurled around, right? Look, in our experience, you know, most people don't actually deliberately go out of their way to put themselves in a conflicting situation, right? The vast majority of people simply don't think about things in great depth. And it is something that needs a bit of thinking through, right? Although as individuals, we intuitively know that having a conflict of interest isn't ideal and it's a bad idea, right? What many of us may not have actually identified is why it's not ideal. And basically, it's not ideal because it can actually lead to biased decision-making, and that has knock-on impacts on the business, the organization, the environment that you're operating in, right? And also people may not have clearly articulated what types of situations or relationships or arrangements can actually create a form of conflict, whether that conflict is an actual one that exists right now, whether it's a potential one that may arise in the coming days, weeks, months, years, or, and crucially, whether it's a perceived conflict. Because we live in a really fast-paced world, and media has a tremendous say in how we behave and interpreting things that we do really quickly, right? So perception is reality. And it's just as important to identify, triage, and manage a perceived conflict as it is to identify, triage, and manage an actual or a potential one. And this is where, sorry, Tony, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so we're talking in terms of the appointment of a son, daughter to a position of high standing within an organisation. We're talking about the awarding of contracts to someone who is related to the key person making those decisions. Yeah. We're talking about the fact that we can't always see clearly if it's someone close to us or related to us when we're making business decisions, which is why we need to have this conversation about conflicts of interest, isn't it, Irene?
It is, exactly. And you're spot on there, because knowledge about the kind of relationships or arrangements that could lead to the existence of a conflict is really important. And it's that front of mind awareness that, you know, we as human beings are multifaceted. We're not one-dimensional, right? We come to work and we have a work life. But outside our work life, we also have a non-work life. And we can't necessarily leave our non-work selves at the office door when we walk into the office, right? So in our non-work selves, we've got social relationships like immediate family, extended family. Yeah. We have friends and we have casual acquaintances. We also have financial arrangements. We've got mortgages. We may have shares in companies. Some of us may manage our own superannuation funds, right? And we also have community arrangements. So some of us may volunteer for organizations. We may be involved in sporting events. And therefore, there's another group of arrangements in our lives. So it's important for us to actually understand that there are times when there can be an overlap between our non-work self and our work self. And it's in that area of overlap where there is the potential for conflicts to arise.
If I can jump in there, we have a great diagram for those that are actually watching via either via LinkedIn or on Facebook. A bit of an illustration, a physical illustration of what that actually looks like from a from a diagrammatical perspective. And it is that crossover between the personal interests and the best interests of the business, recognizing that when we're making decisions in the context of the business environment, there is an expectation that there is openness and transparency around decision making. Decision making is being undertaken for the greater good of the organization as a whole and its shareholders. And so it's that little
thing. So it is actually possible to appoint a member of your family to a position of prominence. However, the rules that govern that relationship should be very clear and very transparent, so that it's clear to everyone that that person you've appointed to that particular position does not have undue influence on bigger decisions, that is not shown a particular favoritism in terms of, say, bonuses, etc., etc. And that's what we're talking about in transparency around conflicts of interest. So, yes, by all means, if an entity is bidding for a body of work, and they're related to the one of the key people that is making the decision around that body of work, that's okay, as long as everyone can clearly see that this is the decision-making process that that person went through, that it was fair and equitable, it was monitored. That's what we're saying, isn't it, Lisa?
Look, it is what we're saying. I would actually take the appointment of a family member into a role in the organisation a slight step further, and that is yes. That the actual appointment process was also open and transparent. So in other words, yes, it's okay to hire your husband, wife, sister, brother, whoever else, but in from a fairness and equity, and this goes back to our conversation last week, Tony, around trust.
Yes, yes.
And so, transparency is a key component of building trust, and so is fairness. And so if there is a role that is opening up within the organisation, it is better practice to openly advertise that role. And if the success candidate with the right knowledge, skills and experience happens to be husband, wife, brother, sister, et cetera, everyone could openly and transparently have the opportunity to vote and see the decision prior to getting into that role. And then what you talked about, Tony, was the management of that conflict, perceived, actual or otherwise, afterwards. And there is really, really great mechanisms when organizations and when companies build great policies around conflicts of interest, they are actually building mechanisms to manage conflicts, because reality is these things come up all the time. They're actually part of life. And even in the best designed governing structures, sometimes things just come up, and it's better to be open, transparent, and manage them. Board members have this dynamic where the organisation all of a sudden is about to, you know, take over a new company that they've actually got, you know, interest in. It's about how that conflict is managed and the transparency around the decision making, so that the individual is actually not involved in part of the process. And of course, Tony, this links very, very strongly into our second topic today too, around ethics and values.
Yes.
It definitely does. Would you like to start having a bit of a chat?
Absolutely. Please.
Great. So we did talk about how trust is an underlying part of decision-making environments, and a component of trust for those that remember the word cloud that that we talked about two shows ago, and we talked about a more detailed one last week. In fact, we talked about two last week. What trust looks like from a heart-centered leader's perspective, as well as from an ego leader, an egocentric leader's perspective. When it comes to decision making, there are some foundational principles that everyone naturally expects that actually build and maintain trust. And a component of that is around the ethics and values being applied by the individual or the group of individuals who are undertaking decision making. And so, I think there was a bit of an interference there in the call. Sorry about that.
There was.
I'm not sure what that was, but.
Sorry, Lisa. Ethics.
So, what we do find is that. Every day, individuals step into their organisational environment applying their own ethics and values based on their conditioning within their home environment. So when organisations don't define the ethics and values that they expect from their employees, we're all walking around being the best humans we can be based on how we were raised. And so those ethical lines are actually at different levels and in different sort of places. And in some cases, organisations actually draw a much stronger ethical line and have certain levels of behaviours that may or may not actually be part of the psyche of their employees. And so what tends to happen is that the word ethics, people have this perception around what it is and what it isn't. And from a definitional standpoint, there's actually two branches. There's actually several branches. But for the purposes of this conversation, ethics really, from a philosophical standpoint, really looks at individuals and their conduct and regarding what is good and what is bad and what is right and what is wrong. And it's how the foundations of respect towards each other actually gets played out. So it's quite black and white. Whereas within organizations, within an organisation or within the context of a business environment, it's actually about the application of ethics and values and how individuals within the business environment should act and how they behave. So this comes back to that conversation we had around the difference of between what to do and how to do it and who to be and how to be.
Yes.
So it's actually it's actually the part of a lot of businesses' perspectives right now around really being clear around what ethics and values are and what their organisation stands for from an ethical standpoint, especially around corporate social responsibility and the application of that.
I was going to say, and that's a key reason why a lot of organisations, regardless of whether they sit in the public or the private sphere, they've got codes of conduct. So they set out in their codes of conduct right up front what the expected standards of behaviour are and what you're likely to expect if you don't meet those standards, right? This because behaviour is an individual, as an individual, how do you monitor it unless you actually have some guidelines of what it is that's expected of you and what you can expect if you don't meet those particular standards, you know? And there's a tied in with this discussion about ethics, there's a lot of talk about what it can mean, and I've heard it described as ethics is the way you behave when no one's watching, you know, which is really
that's
quite
a good description, Irene.
It is, isn't it? Because doesn't it make each of us think, ooh, what do I do when no one's watching, you know? So, but having an ethics and values top-down approach in any organisation and a code of conduct, these are all really key risk management tools for an organisation and a business as well. And they contribute to stable, transparent and reliable decisions that are not influenced by bias, right? They also help provide confidence on a number of levels, so that if you're in a business, your customers have confidence that the business is in good hands. If you have investors in your business, your investors are confident that their investment is being well managed, and your staff who become your ambassadors for how you do business, because they are confident that decisions are being made not with any nasty isms that lead to bias, you know, things like favouritism or nepotism, and that there are processes and tools in place to actually keep all that in check.
Yeah, most definitely. And a lot of organisations are also moving towards more principles-based values and behaviours. There was a time, not actually that long ago, where the code of conduct was a rule book. And it was very black and white. You can do this, you can't do that. However, over time, we found that principles-based decision-making and principles-based ethics and values application within the work environment is a lot more effective because it helps employees manage the shades of grey. And that's what it was with the black and whites, because you'd have this list of can and cannots, but all these shades of grey that weren't really quite fitting into any category kept coming up. And individuals actually do get quite, sometimes quite confused or quite concerned about the rule book not aligning or not providing the support they need. There is a link between the rule book driving towards a compliance-based code culture as opposed to a principles-based culture, where I know that for me, every employee that, you know, works within my environment, I have an expectation that they're using their knowledge, skills and experience in a way that enables them to effectively make decisions, and they're also going to be held to account if they don't get it right. Because they do have the principles, and I do expect them to actually think and not expect all the answers to come to them through some sort of clean list or something like that.
So it's actually a very collaborative relationship in terms of understanding within yourself what's expected of you, identifying areas where there may be that overlap we talked about a little while ago, and then declaring that, going to somebody in your organisation who's in a bit more of a senior position than yourself and declaring and saying, hey, I know we've got a code of conduct. This is my situation in terms of, you know, my sporting association or my investments in this particular company. This is my situation. How does that create any conflict in this environment, given that in my work I'm doing X? Does it create any conflict? So the mere thought of even thinking about it and bringing it front of mind actually goes a long way towards transparency, because the identification and the naming of it enables you to actually possibly label it what it might be. And then it also enables you, together with your organization, to identify what it is and actually determine what management actions need to be taken to eliminate the risks, mitigate the risks, minimize them as much as possible.
So if you have those clearly defined principles and or code of conduct, then the employee is going to know very clearly that this is going to be a conflict of interest. Then it's also their responsibility to make someone aware that there may be a conflict of interest. But then it's the organization's greater responsibility to see how that's managed. And it may simply mean stepping out of a meeting when that particular subject is discussed. It may be being out of the process when a particular decision is made about awarding a body of work, for instance. So it's actually protection for the organisation, protection for the employee, and protection for the greater public in knowing that everything is above board, because no longer can we be in business and organisations where we don't have those clear lines of what is a conflict and what isn't. If it's clearly set out, then there should be no discussion. It either is or it isn't. Or it is a declared conflict of interest, and this is how we managed it to mitigate the risk, because it's a risk. It's a risk to the employee. It's a risk to the organisation. It's a risk, generally speaking, isn't it, Lisa?
Look, it most definitely is. And it's one of those things too where as soon as conflict management issues come up, everyone is watching how they're actually being addressed or not being addressed. Because every time one comes up, we're actually reconfirming that line, or we're making it a harder line, and we're actually making a call on where that line is and how that boundary, that governing boundary is. Or if it's chosen to be walked past, it's now a line that no longer exists, and therefore it's accepted. So the behaviour we walk past is the behaviour we accept. The line that we choose, the conflict management issue we choose to pretend is not there, is actually still there, but it's now an accepted environment or accepted line. One of the challenges with ethics and values frameworks when organisations are actually applying them is they're actually very, very effective, but they do take a little bit of time to take hold in an organisation, Tony. One of the things that I find when I'm speaking to clients about putting new values and behaviours within the organisational context environment is that there needs to be a recognition that when you're drawing a new line like this, that this is about individuals' conditioning and the way they come to work every day. And I've a visual here just to help those that are actually watching. And for those listening, I'll explain it. When we're putting values and behaviours in, we're actually drawing a new line. And this new line is around what we expect from everyone from a behaviour standpoint moving forward. The hindsight application of that line has to not occur. So anything that someone has done prior to that new line being drawn can't be actually constantly thrown in the face of the individual, because the line was never there. It might have been a personal line for someone, but before we draw that line, everyone comes to work every day with their own values and behaviours, and they've applied it to the work around them. There might have been someone walking around saying, well, that's not appropriate and blah, 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 and every leader might be defining their own line. But when an organisation draws that line, moving forward, there's an expectation that individuals come to work every day leaving their personal ethics and values at the door, and they actually are applying the organization's ones. And it can be hard, Tony. It can be hard because when you're drawing those lines, individuals may naturally assimilate because their own personal values are similar, or there might be really big gaps between the organization's values and behaviors and the individuals. I've had situations where in some organizations they've chosen to embed the values and behaviors as part of their performance framework within the organization. Everyone needs to demonstrate how they're moving towards aligning their values and behaviors within the organization as part of the performance conversation, which can actually be really effective. However, most ideally, organizations actually hire with their values and behaviors front and center. In the forefront, because they're hiring people who already have those values and behaviors, and there's no gap to manage. And that management of that gap actually takes time. One of the other things we find too is that these values and behaviors need to be applied across the whole organization from the top down. So one of the challenges we do find, especially with business owners who run their own businesses, they think that values and behaviors are for everyone else, but the actual business owner won't actually behave the same way. Leaders need to remember that they set the tone. They set the tone around values and behaviors and their application, just like they set the tone around every other governing framework, including related party matters and conflicts management. There can't be a rule for one and another rule for everybody else. It just doesn't quite work.
Lisa, if you're working with an organisation where you see the higher level of leaders in that organisation are behaving differently from the expectations of the employees as a whole, how do you manage that as an external person coming in? I'm thinking that that is the best way to manage it, to have someone external come in and manage that. It must be incredibly difficult to try and manage that from within the organization. Is that true?
Look, it definitely is very, very hard for individuals to manage, especially because if the individuals who own the values and behaviors framework hierarchically sit below the leaders that aren't behaving properly, it can be really, really challenging. One of the other things that can be really challenging is that the leaders at the executive level may be behaving the same way the board is, even though the boards approve the values and behaviors. We've seen a couple of dynamics, haven't we, where this plays out.
And it is really difficult, but as externals, when we come in, you can usually tell what the dynamic might be simply through that management level's behaviours, because fatigue sets in after a while. Organisational fatigue sets in, and you will see that management level just below the board absolutely exhausted. And exhaustion is a really big indicator of, okay, what's actually going on here from a culture perspective, right? Because it's very tiring if you are at an executive or just below, like a senior manager level. It's very tiring to manage up and also get on with your day job and look after your staff who are relying on you as well, right? So absenteeism starts to rear its ugly head. You know, that kind of behavior and that kind of indicator is a bit of a flag that, okay, there are things that may not be quite connecting particularly well, you know, between board and senior executive. Let's have a look at what's actually happening in the space of ethics, values and behaviors.
Absolutely.
And in that instance, girls, sorry, Lisa.
Okay.
In that instance, is it the board that gets the governance collective to come in, or is it someone under the senior leaders? Like, how does that dynamic work for you guys?
Yeah, that's actually what I was about to say, Tony. So it typically depends on who brings us into the organisation and how we can work with the key stakeholders internally. So if someone below the level of the executive actually hires us and says, look, I'm the steward of this framework on behalf of the board, they're not doing it and neither are the executive, but everyone else has to set that tone and that environment, set that tone yeah. around values and behaviours, even though it's not actually being reflected from above down. What we actually tend to do is we actually start off by having a bit of a stakeholder interview process, because typically there are people on the executive and people on the board who are going along to get along. In other words, it's not actually who they really are. So you remember last week, Tony, I talked about my journey yes. around becoming a heart-centered governing leader. I was one of those yeah. individuals that was behaving the way I was because I knew that that was the way that behavior was expected with the people around me, for me to fit into yes. those circles and behave in that way. Typically, we can actually flush out or identify potential sponsors of projects like that at the more senior levels uh-huh. by actually having yeah. real conversations with the individuals who are at those levels. So I'd be coming in and I'd actually be interviewing each member of the board, having an informal conversation to understand the dynamics from their perspective, give them context around why we've been brought in. Of course, do that in a very constructive way. So it's actually not a finger point to the problem and we're not the problem situation. It really is more about recognizing that the behaviours that we actually are expecting are the behaviours that have actually been set. The line's been set by the board. And the first question I'd be asking is, are these values and behaviours the ones the organisation really wants?
And do you find that often?
I do. I do find that that there's not a lot of self-awareness, and they also don't realise that there are actually eyes watching and eyes judging.
Because intuitively, in any relationship that involves a number of people, if the relationship is not working, chances are everyone in the relationship knows it's not working.
They may very
well not know how to deal with what the not workings are. But the one thing that is probably common across all of those individuals is that they know something's not working here.
Look, they definitely do. They know it's not working, and they're actually typically, in my experience, they're actually looking and waiting for someone like me and someone like Irene to turn up, because they actually don't know how else to deal with it and they don't know who else to talk to. They don't have any mechanisms to escalate their concern around these matters. And it also really does very strongly depend on the base dynamics of the culture and the environment that they're in. So, for example, some individuals end up on a board because they've been recommended by others. A lot of referral relationship building occurs, and that's how individuals end up on boards. And there are individuals out there whose primary job is to be on a board. They're actually professional directors, professionally paid directors. Yeah. And so it's in their financial interests, of course, to be on some really, really great boards and to hit some goals. But at the same time, they may be stepping into environments where the existing culture is something that they are expected to get along with and go along with. And they don't realise that there's actually other options out there until someone like myself or Irene turn up and start having these real conversations. It can actually sometimes sneak up on boards as well, Tony. Sometimes the board's not actually aware of how the executive are behaving because they've never asked the question, and they don't see them as part of their daily work. What they see is
boards generally only see the CEO and senior management in board meetings. They're not actually generally involved in the day-to-day running of the organisation. So, yes, absolutely, they may not be aware that this is going on. Do you find boards are shocked at the discovery of conflicts of interest, lack of adherence to a code of conduct? Does it take them by surprise?
Look, it does take them by surprise. And typically when those kind of dynamics are playing out and we know we're stepping into those environments, we actually collect some data. We undertake some survey. We do an ethics survey of the organisation, a good cross-section of staff. We safely invite individuals to provide their insights and their perspectives around the ethical culture and the behaviours that are occurring across the organisation. And we share that data with the board members or with the board as a whole for them to get a picture of what's really going on within the organisation environment. Like every other great board paper, I guess, Tony, we provide this holistic view of how effective the framework, the ethical framework's actually being applied in their business, and it's the start of the conversation. We also get some demographics around at what level are the concerns raised, so that the board can get a really clean picture of exactly what level within the organisation these ethical challenges play out.
They might stop at a certain level. Like they may be being escalated by different levels of employees, get to a certain level within an organisation and never go anywhere else. So they don't get to board level for discussion and they just never get resolved. Yeah?
No, they don't. And it's one of those things too, Tony, where creating really great environments where everyone has a voice is really, really important for governance frameworks. And the reason for that is because you don't actually know what information is being filtered by leaders as it goes up the hierarchy. Yes. And so remember when we talked about the risk management framework and risk management processes a couple of shows ago, we talked about the opportunity to do a little bit of a pulse check of what's actually happening within the organisation to identify any risks or issues. There has been, I guess, a couple of situations in my experience, certainly, where we've actually added ethics and values questions to the pulse check and the risk process so that we can get a little bit of a check around what's going on. And what this does is actually create the opportunity for people who may feel they aren't being heard to be heard, because we're not relying on management, you know, for them to talk to their manager and their manager to have a care factor to talk to the next level up, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
What's actually happening is that they're going, wow, I've got an opportunity for a voice here. I'm going to say my piece, and it's not actually going to be filtered or potentially bad news pushed down, which is the other thing we've talked about, good news up, bad news down. That information isn't actually being pushed down. So we do find that there are quite a few mechanisms that we can use within within the governance collective to enable transparency around some of these dynamics, and also starting the conversation around where we are now and where is it that we really need to be. And the perspective around where we need to be is more about how do our people feel, how well does the culture operate, recognizing that there's a knock-on effect to our people, onto our processes, and the delivery of our outcomes to our customers, and therefore, of course, our revenue as well, which is the other part that organizations are quite heavily on.
So essentially what you're saying is that the board actually probably needs to know the culture of the rest of the organisation and not just be presented with the CEO, CFO report. They should actually be having some report back on the general running culture of the business. Absolutely. Does that happen in a lot of cases?
Look, some organisations do invest in a people and culture stream of focus within the business and they can afford it.
Yeah.
It isn't a primary driver for some companies. However, like everything, great boards in their decision-making environments are creating the right types of conversations that aren't just tell me conversations, they're also show me conversations.
Yes.
And there's a difference between the CEO coming in and saying everything's sweet, everything's fine, all good here, nothing to see, as opposed to saying we've surveyed our 3,000 employees and 1,200 people responded, and of the 1,200 people, 80% feel that their values and behaviours are not being reflected by the senior leadership team.
Uh-huh.
And the main
Irene, is that? Sorry, Lisa.
You're good. You're good.
Irene, is that some of the work that you enjoy doing mostly, is to go into an organisation and just
Love
find
it.
Those little things that you can improve? Because it does come down to the bottom line, doesn't it? If all those elements of the governance hierarchy are done and done well, that transforms a business or an organization and has flow through for revenue and customers, doesn't it?
It does. And it's one of the most rewarding areas to actually work in, because when people have those aha moments, it actually has the potential to make life so much better on so many levels, both at the board level, at the executive level. It really also is really instrumental in lifting staff morale. And
yes,
how do you actually get fantastic business? How do you get your business being talked about by your staff in positive ways so they become ambassadors for you and for your brand? Involve them in decisions, be transparent about what is expected of them, and also model the behavior you expect to see in others, right?
Yeah.
It's not a do as I say, it is we all together, right? Because it is, like you said, Tony, it's very transformational on so many levels for an organization, not just the revenue. The revenue will get
yes.
there, but it will get there because your staff are happy, you're very happy in oversighting and how the business is actually traveling. Your investors and your customers can actually see that you are a brand that doesn't just talk the governance talk, but you actually live it. You know, and it is very, very rewarding to do this kind of work.
Fantastic. So, Lisa, we have continued this wonderful conversation about heart-centered leadership and all the different components of heart-centered leadership. And today, that whole conversation about conflicts of interest has been, as you said, an important one to have and to relay to our audience, because you might be sitting on the outside looking at an organization and going, gosh, how did that happen? Why did that happen? How was that allowed to happen? And you actually have the right in a lot of cases to explore why those things happen. So if you're looking at a government, for instance, and this show is starting you to think about, gosh, that really is a conflict of interest. There are avenues for you to have those concerns addressed. And can I say, if you have those concerns, reach out to Lisa and Irene from the Governance Collective, because they will certainly be able to counsel you on a way in which to get your concerns heard at a higher level. And for any organisations and corporations and businesses listening, this is really important stuff. If you want to have a thriving organisation, you need to have this stuff in place. It will not only protect your business, it will help your business thrive. It will help your employees thrive. It will help your board thrive. It will help your CEO thrive. And isn't that a good reason for us to be doing this work from a business and organization level? If that's not a guarantee that you should be thinking about this stuff in your business or corporation, then let's hope that this show has triggered in you some thoughts around that. If you haven't got a code of conduct, why don't you have a code of conduct? If you don't like the words code of conduct, what are the alternatives? Again, Lisa and Irene have this amazing business. That's the stuff they do. That's the stuff they love. That's the stuff that they thrive on. And because they're thriving, they're going to give you good advice, and they're available to help your corporation, business or organization achieve remarkable results by having this stuff in place. And again, it goes back to the protection of the business or organization in the first place. Some of these are key components in a risk management strategy. They will protect you, your CEOs, your board, and your business from things that could go wrong just by simply doing some of this work. And it's very much about recognizing that there is a difference between your work life and behaviors and a difference between your home life and behaviors. And to have certain rules, principles, and understandings around your working life will make life in general much easier, won't it, girls?
Absolutely.
Most definitely. Most definitely. It really is very important that we remember that we spend a lot more time at work than we do at home, although right now I think a lot of people are working from home right now. But we do we do invest in a lot of our own time switching hats. And that hat switching process can be really confusing sometimes. So it is a really important factor to get some really clear advice around how those hats work and having the right policies and frameworks in place within your business to be able to guide you around this decision making is really, really important.
Absolutely. Coming from a corporate perspective myself and now in private business, and particularly having worked with Lisa for these last series of shows, I've got this list on my whiteboard, like, I need to look at this. What are my I know what my values, mission and vision is for my business, but now I'm starting to think at a deeper level and think about some of the risk management stuff that I need to implement in my own business before I grow too much bigger. So again, if you're starting out in business, and or even if you're a small business, this bears thinking about. It bears consideration before you get bigger, and there is no time or there's limited time to get some of this stuff in place. Simple things like role descriptions that set out either a code of conduct, your values, your principles, your mission, and adherence to that value, that will save you so much angst and energy if you have an employee who's not working out, who doesn't fit with the business or the organization. If you've already done that as part of their role description and they've signed off on it, that's a protection, isn't it? And that flows on to all the things that we've been talking about today. Don't wait for a conflict of interest before you think about what that looks like. Do that work now, get it sorted, and leave it. You may never need to use it, let's hope. But damn straight, if you don't have it, you will need to use it at some stage. So my lovely ladies, that's all we have on the show for this week. Irene, thank you so much for coming on Radio Tony Everyday Business with Lisa and I today. It's been a wonderful pleasure to have your thoughts and expertise on the show today. And Lisa, as always, the divine Lisa Coletta from the Governance Collective. Again, reach out to either of these girls. Just email support@governancecollective.com and Lisa will be able to readily answer any of your questions. If you're interested in her heart-centered leadership series, please reach out to Lisa or Irene. The information is also on radiotony.com under co-host. Look for Lisa and you will find links and information. You'll find Lisa's blogs also on my website, Lisa's website. And once again, thank you so much, ladies, for joining me this week. I look forward to our next show next week where we'll continue the conversation and probably do a roundup of all the information that we've covered in the last 5 shows. And that, my wonderful people, is your lot for this week. We will be returning next week, same time, 1 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time, USA, Radio Tony Everyday Business with Lisa Coletta. Thank you, Irene. Thank you, Lisa. Bye for now.